This podcast is a part of the Policies That Perpetuate Systemic Racism project, supported by the Canada Race Relations Foundation. Join us as we explore the impact of the policy Zero Tolerance for Barbaric Cultural Practices Act. Through insightful conversations, we aim to shed light on the real-world consequences of this policy.
Welcome back to our podcast on the Zero Tolerance for Barbaric Cultural Practices Act. We have arrived at the final episode of our series, where we have been dissecting the stereotypes and problematic notions associated with this policy. Throughout our discussions, we've addressed the inefficiency of criminalizing gender-based violence, how stereotypes affect survivors, and the power dynamics that sustain gender-based violence. This episode strikes a note of optimism. We will listen to service providers and academics discuss best practices for supporting survivors and explore ways to progress beyond the endemic nature of gender-based violence. Addressing any form of gender-based violence, as experts emphasize, requires putting survivor narratives and survivors' needs at the forefront. Achieving this goal requires changes on multiple levels. Firstly, we start with the structural changes needed to cultivate an environment where survivors feel valued, respected, understood, and where their healing journey is prioritized. As we discussed in episode 4, immigrant women face additional barriers such as stereotypes, judgment, barriers related to their positionality, like precarious immigration status, racism, and language barriers, which complicate their access to adequate care and justice. Shalini Konur, Executive Director of SALCO, sheds light on the structural reforms essential for assisting survivors and combating all forms of gender-based violence.
Yeah, so I think there's so many. So one, on the very basics, we need to remove immigration status as a barrier for people to get income support and public housing. Because at the very basic level, for somebody to be able to improve what their situation, if they want to leave, they need to have those core things in place so they can live.
Yeah.
They need to be able to leave and live. And then number two, we really need to think about that immigration piece. Our country is bringing in droves and droves of people from primarily racialized communities across the world as international students, as temporary workers, as people coming on visas who are falling out of status. And we have a massive non-status population in this country. If they're facing violence, we need to actually legislate a solution that gives them a pathway to permanent residence so they're just secure, right? Not these hoops that they have to run through and apply and takes 4 or 5 years and maybe you'll get it, maybe you won't, right? We need reform in family law. If people want to access the family courts in these situations, across the country, access to justice is a mess. We know 70 to 75% of people have to go into a family court unrepresented. If you think about someone who's faced violence, the trauma of that is likely low income at this point, having to go into a family court by themselves, it's a disaster, right? So on family law, we really need to think about that. We need better supports for people in terms of when they have to go through the criminal process, that they feel supported to do that and that they're not re-traumatized. And on policy level, we need to be able to fund organizations that work in communities to get in and have those conversations. What happens now is we do that already. And we do it because we want to, but we do it for free. We are never funded in the way that large mainstream not-for-profits in this country are funded, but we are told these are important, vulnerable, marginalized communities, but you're talking out of two sides of your mouth. They're important, vulnerable, marginalized, but you're not really going to provide us any supports to do that really important work in communities. So across the board, there has to be a complete systems change. And it's not a secret. The federal government has a roadmap to a national action plan on gender-based violence that I, and I think at least 70 other people across the country who are experts in this, worked on, that told them all of it, right? It's in the hands of provinces, territories, and the federal government. none of what I'm saying is a secret or a surprise. It's all been told, but we need the will to make those changes if we really want to support these populations.
In addition to these essential structural changes on different levels that Shalini outlines, providing culturally responsive training to service providers working with survivors of gender-based violence is also crucial. This training, free from judgment and cultural biases, is a vital strategy that all service providers must adopt. This includes counselors, legal professionals, shelter workers, police, and others in related fields. Such training ensures a supportive and understanding environment for survivors, free from the complexities of cultural misinterpretations. Sabrina Zrock offers insights on the importance and impact of this approach.
Okay, so developing a sense of cultural responsiveness. So Muslim women are tired of retaining a lawyer and then educating that lawyer on aspects that are important to them, like mehr or what a khula is. And for example, if you are on legal aid and you have a limited amount of hours and you are spending so many of those hours educating your lawyer on nuances that are specific to your experience, that's not helpful. Gaining cultural responsiveness, educating yourself in terms of increasing your cultural competency is extremely important for service providers and those. Also being non-judgmental is important because we really don't know. Various people have various different interpretations, various cultures, various ways of living, and we don't know if it works for them, then it works for them. We don't need to have a judgment. It's unsolicited, it's unhelpful, and it's very condescending. Yeah, and I think the biggest piece though would be just developing your cultural competency. So there are webinars that you can take. There are PDFs that you can read. You can inform yourself on the specific cultures and the nuances that these clients go through, the nuanced situations that these clients go through, so that when you are working with these clients, you are especially helpful. If you can also provide translation services, for example, for those who have in-person services, they can ensure that, for example, they have halal options. Understanding different differences in how people may greet each other is important. There are so many levels to just gaining a sense of cultural competency, and that no one is perfect. And then understanding that you're always learning about a different culture, right?
Continuing the same conversation, next we hear from Deepa Mathu, who highlights other societal aspects where training and awareness is needed to inform supportive care.
For police, it's about their sensitivity training and their understanding of trauma. For judiciary, again, it is their understanding of this violence and its implication and its presence in their current court cases and how it should be looked at from the angle of whether it is about reason behind the violence or the pattern of the course of control, all of those pieces. Our lawyers need to be trained on how to bring forward these cases in the complexities of sometimes as simple as applying for annulment of the marriage, which we see that in some forced marriage cases, people want to apply for that. And some lawyers don't even know how to engage with that simple process. So the lawyers need training, and there needs to be policies around how do you do a better training for all the legal actors in terms of various forms of gender-based violence, which are less understood.
This cultural sensitivity assists in building trust between care providers and survivors. Tanya Buller, mental health counselor at Punjabi Community Health Services, elaborates the importance of trust building.
Another thing that I think is that we need to do some work on is building trust between the communities and authorities. I think when we have these policies that focus on a specific culture and make them out to be the root cause of violence, even the authorities, when they get a phone call from, say, a South Asian home or a Muslim family home, they are already going to be biased because they're like, oh, it's proximity this, the woman's going to be, they have their own ideologies. And that creates, even if it's not what's going on, and it could be any number of things, but they go into it with stigmatization, and that makes it harder for these communities to trust the authorities again.
Professionals also emphasize the necessity of offering feminist, intersectional, trauma-informed, and survivor-centric support at every stage of a survivor's journey, ranging from police interactions to mental health services. Sabrina Zrock explains further.
A trauma-informed, survivor-centered, intersectional feminist approach is extremely important. So that means you are sensitive to the traumas that this person may be going through when they come into your care, that you are survivor-centered, so you are not telling this person how best to go about their situation. You believe that this person knows best. They know what is best for them. So then you center them and you ask them what they need, and then you support them in achieving that. And then being intersectional is understanding that they come with various identities and that those identities can lead to various barriers, and to understand that when dealing with this client.
Survivor-centric services also entail incorporating feedback directly from survivors, as Tanya reminds us.
Yeah, I think we need to think beyond criminalization. Rather than having focus on criminalization, these acts, which they are already illegal, but the focus should be on encouraging survivors to seek support and to reduce further violence. Providing culturally appropriate services is a huge need. Like we talked about a little bit before, the shelters need to really be your home away from home, even for someone from a different culture. And also, all of these things that I'm sharing with you is feedback that I have heard from survivors themselves during all my time working with them. It should be an absolute must that the input from these survivors should be taken into consideration when we are creating policies and programs for these survivors. So these survivors need to have a seat at the table where these decisions are being made.
As an example of survivor-centric services, Shalini highlights the way Selco provides legal support from a survivor-centric perspective to clients dealing with various forms of gender-based violence, including forced marriages.
So we get forced marriage client calls regularly. In 2022, I worked with about 32 clients with the data in Ontario. And so it's a mix of things, because clients, when they call you, are coming in at different spaces in what they want to do. And so the first thing is really to think about, okay, what do you want? What is the outcome that you're looking for? And in terms of support, it's gone all the way from trying to figure out if somebody's leaving or has left, how to regularize their immigration status so that they're not removed from the country. It's supporting clients to do ID document replacement because they often don't have access to their own passports, their own SIM cards, their own birth certificates. If they have been forced into marriage, it's supporting them with family law issues around what they want to do. And then there are the clients that we've worked with who have been taken out of the country. So that work is around connecting with global affairs, connecting with the client, connecting with amazing not-for-profit agencies in home country to figure out how can we get this person back to Canada, which is a very difficult exercise sometimes. And then, of course, beyond the legal side is the non-legal side, right? The basics of life for people around, where am I going to live? Where am I going to get income to support myself? Most of these clients will need support in terms of physical and mental health issues that are going on for them at the same time. So trying to connect them to that network of people. And there are a lot of clients that we've had, I'd say roughly 30 to 40%, where it's just so hard that they actually end up going back to the situations that they left, right? And there's no judgment from us at all, because it occurs to me all the time that this is too hard. How is this young person handling this? Our system is not supporting them in the way that it needs to. And it's thinking about safety from all of those angles and how what we can do to help people to stay the safest that they can be, given whatever choice they want.
Education and training goes beyond just for service providers. Deepa highlights the value of education in instilling a sense of empowerment and awareness in the general public, which can then help tackle the root cause of gender-based violence.
I think education is the key. Education is where it all basically starts. I feel education in our school system needs to rethink. An education system needs to rethink what are the tools that we are giving people. to stop the cycle of violence of various kinds. This is one kind of violence we're talking about, but I also say that our school system is also responsible for stopping domestic violence and sexual violence in our society. And our school system and education system needs to start thinking about what is their purpose in our current society, where you can pretty much Google anything and everything. So when we have come to a point as a society in our evolution where the access to the resources of education is one click away for everyone, then should they start not focusing on giving skills and tools for people to have empowerment and agency in their life in a different way? So I think they need to rethink what we are doing and what is the impact of what we are doing in our schools, because there can be a huge change if there's right kind of education given to young girls, young boys, trans kids and same-sex kids, LGBTQS2 community. I think there can be a huge change that can happen. At the same time, investment in education and collaboration and encouragement and collaboration to our service system providers, which is our frontline service system providers and health service system providers who do enforcement work, social workers, and people who do income security and social work from basically as a social welfare state, to folks who are in entertainment and media industry. I think the responsibility lies with everyone, including the education institutions, which are much larger, like universities. I think the responsibility lies with everyone. The education and training is absolutely needed, and people need to identify the risks when someone is facing risks, and they need to be identifying where they need their supports, provide proper safety planning, proper exit planning from the situation of the violence in a trauma-centric and trauma-informed and client-centric way.
Apart from structural changes, effectively countering gender-based violence involves the creation of safe spaces for survivors, spaces where they can feel heard and respected. As various service providers have pointed out in previous episodes, survivors often grapple with intense feelings of guilt, shame, and loneliness. Supportive network is vital for their healing and growth. Building a community can be as straightforward as providing a judgment-free space for survivors to openly share and discuss their concerns. An example of this is an anonymous virtual support group run by Tanya at PCHS, which offers a safe and confidential environment for survivors to connect and find solace.
We have a women's growth circle group that we run where it's any woman going through, they could be going through abuse or some sort of issues in their relationships, they're encouraged to attend. And it's an online group, but it's without video. And we found that has really helped women find a common connecting place. They connect with one another, even if things are not good. I think speaking to someone, hearing other people going through similar issues gives you a lot of hope and that connection with the community that they were missing. And they suddenly don't feel so lonely, and they have ideas and they have all these resources and they have all these people they can talk to and ask about support. And it that makes a huge difference when you're versus being stuck alone and going through it and thinking about the one person going through it and you have no choice, right? So I think we need more groups like this and more culturally appropriate services. Women feel like it is their right to get this, and it's not. Even today, whenever we support any South Asian women, they're always so thankful and appreciative because this is not something they expect, but this is their right. Yeah. We have a lot of work to be done until women demand support. They're like, I need support. I'm alone. I'm stuck. What can you do for me? Or where can I go? Yeah. So I hope we can keep working towards this and make it more a reality where women know that they where to go and what to do when they are in a position where they need support.
Centering survivors' stories, their voices, and their resilience is a fundamental step towards forging a future free from violence and also in building a supportive community. Dr. Jamal reminds us that women across communities have consistently been vocal about their rights. However, this narrative is erased from the mainstream discourse. By focusing on these voices, we not only show respect for those who resist, but also foster a sense of community and belonging.
Muslim women or South Asian women from their communities have been fighting gender-based violence, challenging them for centuries. In South Asia, these struggles have, in many other Muslim countries, these struggles against these any oppressive structures, against violence, against patriarchal dominance by oppressive versions of religion and faith and culture being imposed by religious and other cultures, political leaders, women have always been involved in these struggles. There are many women who are involved in informal ways within the family, within the household, within the community. But they have also, there's also been organized struggles in which women have come out onto the streets, challenged even militarily, from military dictatorships to kings to religious leaders. It's part of the folklore. It's part of the history that we draw on, and even in stories that are retold and told again, tales such as Heer Ranjha, for instance, in which he actually accuses the religious leader for misrepresenting her rejection of the marriage contract. Whereas people have challenged these different kinds of violence in their own ways at many different levels. This is not as if certain communities or certain groups of women have been just waiting for a civilized culture to come and tell us what our problems are and how to solve them. And I think we need to develop a respect for those struggles that are ongoing and to actually not just listen to them, but to listen to them and to take them seriously.
Yeah.
Survivor stories of community-based workers, other social workers from ethnic and racialized groups.
Next, we turn to Dr. Messina, who highlights various creative methods to showcase these stories of resilience and resistance. She also highlights the significance of mentorship in nurturing a sense of community.
There was something actually quite incredible and beautiful about that, around seeing yourself always connected to other people in your family and community, and that collective sense of identity can be incredibly empowering and powerful. I was always drawn to moving stories in a way that was about demonstrating the resistance and empowerment of women, rather than focusing on the trauma and the violence. And at the same time, recognizing that those are parts of our stories and we need to hear them. And so using arts-based methods has been an incredible way to access those stories, to move them to that place of beauty and resilience and resistance. Using poetry has been one of the ways that I've done that. Writing short stories, art, like mural work has been essential to my work nowadays. And I've done some really awesome work with this amazing group called the Fearless Collective out in India. And they do this incredible work to move people's experiences of fear and violence to love and reclamation. And now I use a lot of arts-based mural work in my work with communities as well. What I love about the shifts that have happened in technology and arts-based methods is that just you can tap into so much more. And I think some really important ways is using social media and public media as a way to broaden the conversation within our communities through music, through podcasts like what you're doing here, through radio, through Instagram posts, to social media, part of the newer generation of conversations. And our parents and grandparents are tapping into it, fascinating enough. Like, they want to look at TikTok videos and be part of them and be part of the conversation. So I think there's ways to resist those dominant stories of violence and patriarchy and to offer different versions of them. And I've seen, like, I follow a few people on Instagram that do really great work around that. But I think what my big mission now is to mentor and encourage folks within our community to take up these kinds of spaces. Like, let's not continue to go down paths, like academic paths that stereotypically acknowledge, which are being in the medical field or engineering or business, we do need more folks within the academic context to do research and to be in the social service sector, talking and pushing back and engaging in these bigger conversations. And these are really valuable spaces for us to show up. And so my big push as an academic and instructor, faculty member at the University of Victoria is to mentor young South Asian women or men or gender diverse folks who want to continue these conversations in this space and to give them multiple opportunities to do that.
Change within communities is already underway. The professionals I've consulted have observed a noticeable shift in the dialogue surrounding gender-based violence. However, the challenge lies in undertaking this internal work. External perceptions continue to be mired in stereotypes. After 7 years of this legislation, the stories of survivors and the impact of this policy have demonstrated its inability in addressing any form of gender-based violence. For real progress, this policy needs to be rescinded to prevent further institutionalization of racism. Also, to address issues of gender-based violence effectively, the recommendations of service providers must be heeded and integrated into the government strategies. Only then can we hope to see meaningful change in the way gender-based violence is approached and handled. Thank you for listening to this series. We hope it has provided you with valuable insights. If you have any comments or suggestions, please feel free to share them in the comment section below. Your feedback is greatly appreciated.